Obviously, parties to a bargain were acting on the expectation that cooperation would yield more than acting alone. Somehow, the parties reached an agreement to share the pie. How they would split it depended on bargaining power, but on that score, economic theory had nothing to say, and there was no way of finding one solution in the haystack of possible solutions that met this rather broad criterion. Edgeworth admitted defeat. The general answer is, a contract without competition is indeterminate. Over the next century, a half-dozen great economists, including the Englishman John Hicks and Alfred Marshall, and the Dane F. Zeuthen, took up Edgeworth's problem. But they too ended up throwing up their hands. Newman and Morgenstern suggested that the answer lay in reformulating the problem as a game of strategy, but they themselves did not succeed in solving it. Nash took a completely novel approach to the problem by predicting how two rational bargainers will interact. Instead of defining a solution directly, he started by writing down a set of reasonable conditions that any plausible solution would have to satisfy, and then looked at where they took him. This is called the axiomatic approach, a method that had swept mathematics in the 1920s, was used by von Neumann in his book on quantum theory and his papers on set theory, and was in its heyday at Princeton in the late 1940s. Nash's paper is one of the first to apply the axiomatic method to a problem in the social sciences. Recall that Edgeworth had called the problem of the bargain indeterminate. In other words, if all one knew about the bargainers were their preferences, one couldn't predict how they would interact, or how they would divide the pie. The reason for the indeterminacy would have been obvious to Nash. There wasn't enough information, so one had to make additional assumptions. Nash's theory assumes that both sides' expectations about each other's behavior are based on the intrinsic features of the bargaining situation itself. The essence of a situation that results in a deal is two individuals who have the opportunity to collaborate for mutual benefit in more than one way. How they will split the gain, he reasoned, reflects how much the deal is worth to each individual. He started by asking the question, what reasonable conditions would any solution, any split, have to satisfy? He then posed four conditions, and using an ingenious mathematical argument, showed that if his axioms held, a unique solution existed that maximized the product of the player's utilities. In a sense, his contribution was not so much to solve the problem as to state it in a simple and precise way, so as to show that unique solutions were possible. The striking feature of Nash's paper is not its difficulty or its depth, or even its elegance and generality, but rather that it provides an answer to an important problem. Reading Nash's paper today, one is struck most by its originality. The ideas seem to come out of the blue. There's some basis for this impression. Nash arrived at his essential idea, the notion that the bargain depended on a combination of the negotiator's backup alternatives and the potential benefits of striking a deal. As an undergraduate at Carnegie Tech, before he came to Princeton, before he started attending Tucker's game theory seminar, and before he had read von Neumann and Morgenstern's book, it occurred to him while he was sitting in the only economics course he would ever attend. The course, on international trade, was taught by a clever and young Viennese emigre in his 30s named Bert Hoslitz. Hoslitz, who emphasized theory in his course, had degrees in law and economics, the latter from the University of Chicago. International agreements between governments and between monopolies had dominated trade, especially in commodities between the wars, and Hoslitz was an expert on the subject of international cartels and trade. Nash took the course in his final semester in the spring of 1948 simply to fulfill degree requirements. As always, though, the big unsolved problem was the bait. The problem concerned trade deals between countries with separate currencies, as he told Roger Meyerson, a game theorist at Northwestern University in 1996. One of Nash's axioms, if applied in an international trade context, asserts that the outcome of the bargain shouldn't change if one country revalued its currency. Once at Princeton, Nash would have quickly learned about von Neumann and Morgenstern's theory and recognized that the arguments that he'd thought of in Hoslitz's class had a much wider applicability. Very likely, Nash sketched his ideas for a bargaining solution in Tucker's seminar, and was urged by Oscar Morgenstern, whom Nash invariably referred to as Oscar Lamorgue, to write a paper. Legend, possibly encouraged by Nash himself, soon had it that he'd written the whole paper in Hoselitz's class, much as Milner solved the Borsuk problem in knot theory as a homework assignment, and that he had arrived at Princeton with the bargaining paper tucked into his briefcase. Nash has since corrected the record, but when the paper was published in 1950 in Econometrica, the leading journal of mathematical economics, Nash was careful to retain full credit for the ideas. The author wishes to acknowledge the assistance of Professors von Neumann and Morgenstern, who read the original form of the paper and gave helpful advice as to the presentation. And in his Nobel autobiography, Nash makes it clear that it was his interest in the bargaining problem that brought him into contact with the game theory group at Princeton, not the other way around. As a result of that exposure to economic ideas and problems, I arrived at the idea that led to the paper The Bargaining Problem, which was later published in Econometrica. And it was this idea which in turn, when I was a graduate student at Princeton, led to my interest in the game theory studies there. Chapter 10. Nash's Rival Idea. Princeton, 1949-50. I was playing a non-cooperative game in relation to von Neumann, rather than simply seeking to join his coalition. John F. Nash, Jr., 1993. In the summer of 1949, Albert Tucker caught the mumps from one of his children. He had planned to be in Palo Alto, California, where he was to spend his sabbatical year, by the end of August. Instead, he was in his office at Fine, gathering up some books and papers, when Nash walked in to ask whether Tucker would be willing to supervise his thesis. Nash's request caught him by surprise. Tucker had little direct contact with Nash during the latter's first year, and had been under the impression that he would probably write a thesis with Steenrod. But Nash, who offered no real explanation, told Tucker only that he thought he had found some good results related to game theory. Tucker, who was still feeling out of sorts and eager to get home, agreed to become his advisor, only because he was sure that Nash would still be in the early stages of his research by the time he returned to Princeton the following summer. 6 weeks later, Nash and another student were buying beers for a crowd of graduate students and professors in the bar in the basement of the Nassau Inn, as tradition demanded of men who had just passed their generals. The mathematicians were growing more boisterous and drunken by the minute. A limerick competition was in full swing. The object was to invent the cleverest, dirtiest rhyme about a member of the Princeton mathematics department, preferably about one of the ones present, and shout it at the top of one's lungs. At one point, a shaggy Scot, aptly named McBeath, jumped to his feet, beer bottle in hand, and began to belt out stanza after stanza of a popular and salacious drinking song, with the others chiming in for the chorus. "I put my hand upon her breast, she said, young man, I like that best." Chorus, "Gosh, gore, blimey, how ashamed I was." That night, with its quaint masculine rite of passage, marked the effective end of Nash's years as a student. He had been trapped in Princeton for an entire hot and sticky summer, forced to put aside the interesting problems he'd been thinking about, to cram for the general examination. Luckily, Lefschetz had appointed a friendly trio of examiners, Church Steenrod and a visiting professor from Stanford, Donald Spencer. The whole nerve-wracking event had gone rather well. Many mathematicians, most famously the French genius Henri Poincaré, have testified to the value of leaving a partially solved problem alone for a while and letting the unconscious work behind the scenes. In an oft-quoted passage from a 1908 essay about the genesis of mathematical discovery, Poincaré writes, "For 15 days I struggled to prove that no functions analogous to those I have since called Fuchsian functions could exist. I was then very ignorant. Every day I sat down at my work table where I spent an hour or two. I tried a great number of combinations and arrived at no result. I then left Caen, where I was living at the time, to participate in a geological trip sponsored by the School of Mines. The exigencies of travel made me forget my mathematical labors. Reaching Coutances, we took a bus for some excursion or another. The instant I put my foot on the step, the idea came to me, apparently with nothing whatever in my previous thoughts having prepared me for it. Nash's wasted summer, with its enforced break from his research, proved unexpectedly fruitful, allowing several vague hunches from the spring to crystallize and mature. That October he started to experience a virtual storm of ideas. Among them was his brilliant insight into human behavior, the Nash Equilibrium. Nash went to see von Neumann a few days after he passed his generals. He wanted, he had told the secretary cockily, to discuss an idea that might be of interest to Professor von Neumann. It was a rather audacious thing for a graduate student to do. Von Neumann was a public figure, had very little contact with Princeton graduate students outside of occasional lectures, and generally discouraged them from seeking him out with their research problems, but it was typical of Nash, who had gone to see Einstein the year before with the germ of an idea. Von Neumann was sitting at an enormous desk, looking more like a prosperous bank president than an academic, in his expensive three-piece suit, silk tie, and jaunty pocket handkerchief. He had the preoccupied air of a business executive. At the time, he was holding a dozen consultancies, arguing the ear off Robert Oppenheimer, over the development of the H-bomb, and overseeing the construction and programming of two prototype computers. He gestured Nash to sit down. He knew who Nash was, of course, but seemed a bit puzzled by his visit. He listened carefully, with his head cocked slightly to one side, and his fingers tapping. Nash started to describe the proof he had in mind for an equilibrium in games of more than two players. But before he had gotten out more than a few disjointed sentences, von Neumann interrupted, jumped ahead to the yet unstated conclusion of Nash's argument, and said abruptly, "That's trivial, you know, that's just a fixed-point theorem." It is not altogether surprising that the two geniuses should clash. They came at game theory from two opposing views of the way people interact. Von Neumann, who had come of age in European café discussions and collaborated on the bomb and computers, thought of people as social beings who were always communicating. It was quite natural for him to emphasize the central importance of coalitions and joint action in society. Nash tended to think of people as out of touch with one another and acting on their own. For him, a perspective founded on the ways that people react to individual incentives seemed far more natural. Von Neumann's rejection of Nash's bid for attention and approval must have hurt, however, and one guesses that it was even more painful than Einstein's earlier but kindlier dismissal. He never approached von Neumann again. Nash later rationalized von Neumann's reaction as the naturally defensive posture of an established thinker to a younger rival's idea, a view that may say more about what was in Nash's mind when he approached von Neumann than about the older man. Nash was certainly conscious that he was implicitly challenging von Neumann. Nash noted in his Nobel autobiography that his ideas deviated somewhat from the line, as if of political party lines, of von Neumann and Morgenstern's book. Velleius, the Roman philosopher, was the first to offer a theory for why geniuses often appeared not as lonely giants, but in clusters in particular fields, in particular cities. He was thinking of Plato and Aristotle, Pythagoras and Archimedes, and Aeschylus, Euripides, Sophocles, and Aristophanes. But there are many later examples as well, including Newton and Locke, or Freud, Jung, and Adler. He speculated that creative geniuses inspired envy as well as emulation, and attracted younger men who were motivated to complete and recast the original contribution. In a letter to Robert Leonard, Nash wrote a further twist. "I was playing a non-cooperative game in relation to von Neumann, rather than simply seeking to join his coalition. And of course it was psychologically natural for him not to be entirely pleased by a rival theoretical approach." In his opinion, von Neumann never behaved unfairly. Nash compares himself to a young physicist who challenged Einstein, noting that Einstein was initially critical of Kaluza's five-dimensional unified theory of gravitational and electric fields, but later supported its publication. Nash, so often oblivious to the feelings and motivations of other people, was quick in this case to pick up on certain emotional undercurrents, especially envy and jealousy. In a way, he saw rejection as the price genius must pay. A few days after the disastrous meeting with von Neumann, Nash accosted David Gale. "I think I've found a way to generalize von Neumann's min-max theorem," he blurted out. "The fundamental idea is that in a two-person zero-sum solution, the best strategy for both is..." "The whole theory is built on it, and it works with any number of people and doesn't have to be a zero-sum game." Gale recalls Nash's saying, "I'd call this an equilibrium point." The idea of equilibrium is that it is a natural resting point that tends to persist. Unlike von Neumann, Gale saw Nash's point. "Hmm," he said. "That's quite a thesis." Gale realized that Nash's idea applied to a far broader class of real-world situations than von Neumann's notion of zero-sum games. "He had a concept that generalized to disarmament," Gale said later. But Gale was less entranced by the possible applications of Nash's idea than its elegance and generality. "The mathematics was so beautiful, it was so right mathematically." Once again, Gale acted as Nash's agent. "I said this is a great result," Gale recalled. "This should get priority." He told Nash that he was sure that Nash had a brilliant thesis in hand, but he also urged Nash to take credit for the result right away before someone else came up with a similar idea. Gale suggested asking a member of the National Academy of Sciences to submit the proof to the Academy's monthly proceedings. "He was spacey. He would never have thought of doing that," Gale said recently. "So he gave me his proof and I drafted the NAS note." Lefschetz submitted the note immediately and it appeared in the November proceedings. Gale added later, "I certainly knew right away that it was a thesis. I didn't know it was a Nobel." Almost 50 years later, 2 months before his death, Tucker could not recall getting Nash's first draft of the thesis, which Nash mailed to him at Stanford, or his own reaction on reading it, other than being surprised that Nash had produced a result so quickly. He was certain, however, that he had not been bowled over. He said, "Whether or not this was of any interest to economists wasn't known." Nash used to say that Tucker was a machine, implying that Tucker was methodical but unimaginative. But in fact, Nash was quite astute to have chosen him as an advisor. Tucker, a Canadian, Methodist rigidity notwithstanding, possessed a rare willingness to defend unconventional ideas and individuals. A truly fine teacher, he firmly believed that students should choose research topics they felt passionate about, not ones they merely believed would appeal to their professors. A few years later, it was Tucker who convinced another young offbeat genius, who would go on to become one of the fathers of artificial intelligence, Marvin L. Minsky, to drop the mainstream but boring mathematics problem he had chosen as a thesis topic, and instead to write on his real passion, the structure of the brain. Tucker always claimed that he did little more than sign off on Nash's slender 27-page dissertation. "There was no essential role played by me," Tucker said. But he encouraged Nash to get it out quickly and defended its merits within the department. Kuhn, who was close to Tucker at the time, later recalled, "The thesis itself was completed and submitted after the persistent urging and counsel of Professor Tucker. John always wanted to add more material, and Tucker had the wisdom to say, 'Get the results out early.'" Tucker responded to Nash's first draft by demanding that Nash include a concrete example of his equilibrium idea. He also suggested a number of changes in Nash's presentation. "I urged him to deal with a particular case, rather than only a general case," Tucker said. The recommendation to his mind was largely aesthetic. "When you deal with the general case, you have to deal with sophisticated notation that is very hard to read," he said. Nash responded with a prolonged silence that was in fact a measure of his fury. He reacted unfavorably, largely by expressing nothing. "I didn't hear from him again for a long time," Tucker recalled. Nash was actually considering dropping the thesis with Tucker and pursuing another topic, an ambitious problem in algebraic geometry, with Steenrod instead. He chose to interpret Tucker's demands for revisions, along with von Neumann's coldly dismissive reaction, as signs that the department would not accept his work on game theory for a dissertation. However, Tucker, who could be surprisingly forceful, eventually convinced Nash to stick with his original conception and to make the requested changes. Nash had an answer for everything, he said. You couldn't catch him out in a mathematical fault. A May 10th letter to Lefschetz reads, "It is not necessary that I see the revised draft, for he has kept me informed almost daily of the progress of the revision." Tucker adds, "I was delighted to notice a pleasant change of attitude in Nash during the course of our long correspondence on his work. He became much more cooperative and appreciative towards the end. I wrote to him like a Dutch uncle, but I suspect you or someone else at the Princeton end had some influence on effecting the change." The entire edifice of game theory rests on two theorems, von Neumann's min-max theorem of 1928 and Nash's equilibrium theorem of 1950. One can think of Nash's theorem as a generalization of von Neumann's, as Nash did, but also as a radical departure. Von Neumann's theorem was the cornerstone of his theory of games of pure opposition, so-called two-person zero-sum games. But two-person zero-sum games have virtually no relevance to the real world. Even in war, there is almost always something to be gained from cooperation. Nash introduced the distinction between cooperative and non-cooperative games. Cooperative games are games in which players can make enforceable agreements with other players. In other words, as a group, they can fully commit themselves to specific strategies. In contrast, in a non-cooperative game, such collective commitment is impossible. There are no enforceable agreements. By broadening the theory to include games that involved a mix of cooperation and competition, Nash succeeded in opening the door to applications of game theory to economics, political science, sociology, and ultimately evolutionary biology. Although Nash used the same strategic form as von Neumann had proposed, his approach is radically different. More than half of the von Neumann and Morgenstern book deals with cooperative theory. In addition, von Neumann and Morgenstern's solution concept, something called a stable set, does not exist for every game. By contrast, Nash proved on page 6 of his thesis that every non-cooperative game with any number of players has at least one Nash equilibrium point. To understand the beauty of Nash's result, write Avinash Dixit and Barry Nailbuff in Thinking Strategically, one begins with the notion that interdependence is the distinguishing feature of games of strategy. The outcome of a game for one player depends on what all the other players choose to do, and vice versa. Games like tic-tac-toe and chess involve one kind of interdependence. The players move in sequence, each aware of the other's moves. The principle for a player in a sequential move game is to look ahead and reason back. Each player tries to figure out how the other players will respond to his current move, how he will respond in turn, and so forth. The player anticipates where his initial decision will ultimately lead and uses the information to make his current best choice. In principle, any game that ends after a finite sequence of moves can be solved completely. The player's best strategy can be determined by looking ahead to every possible outcome. For chess, in contrast to tic-tac-toe, the calculations are too complex for the human brain, or even for computer programs written by humans. Players look a few moves ahead and try to evaluate the resultant positions on the basis of experience. Games like poker, on the other hand, involve simultaneous moves. In contrast to the linear chain of reasoning for sequential games, a game with simultaneous moves involves a logical circle, write Dixit and Nailbuff. Although players act at the same time, in ignorance of other players' current actions, each is forced to think about the fact that there are other players, who in turn are similarly aware. Poker is an example of I think he thinks that I think that he thinks that I think. Each must figuratively put himself in the shoes of all and try to calculate the outcome. His own best action is an integral part of the calculation. Such circular reasoning would seem to have no conclusion. Nash squared the circle using a concept of equilibrium whereby each player picks his best response to what the others do. Players look for a set of choices such that each person's strategy is best for him, when all others are playing their best strategies. Sometimes one person's best choice is the same, no matter what the others do. That is called a dominant strategy for that player. At other times, one player has a uniformly bad choice, a dominated strategy, in the sense that some other choice is best for him irrespective of what the others do. The search for equilibrium should begin by looking for dominant strategies and eliminating dominated ones. But these are special and relatively rare cases. In most games, each player's best choice does depend on what the others do, and one must turn to Nash's construct. Nash defined equilibrium as a situation in which no player could improve his or her position by choosing an alternative available strategy, without implying that each person's privately held best choice will lead to a collectively optimal result. He proved that for a certain very broad class of games, of any number of players, at least one equilibrium exists, so long as one allows mixed strategies. But some games have many equilibria, and others, relatively rare ones that fall outside the class he defined, may have none. Today, Nash's concept of equilibrium from strategic games is one of the basic paradigms in social sciences and biology. It is largely the success of his vision that has been responsible for the acceptance of game theory as, in the words of the new Palgrave, a powerful and elegant method of tackling a subject that had become increasingly baroque. Much as Newtonian methods of celestial mechanics had displaced the primitive and increasingly ad hoc methods of the ancients. Like many great scientific ideas, from Newton's theory of gravitation to Darwin's theory of natural selection, Nash's idea seemed initially too simple to be truly interesting, too narrow to be widely applicable, but later on so obvious that its discovery by someone was deemed all but inevitable. As Reinhard Zeltan, the German economist who shared the 1994 Nobel with Nash and John C. Harzanyi, said, "Nobody would have foretold the great impact of the Nash equilibrium on economics and social science in general. It was even less expected that Nash's equilibrium point concept would ever have any significance for biological theory." Its significance was not immediately recognized, not even by the brash 21-year-old author himself, and certainly not by the genius who inspired Nash, von Neumann. Chapter 11. Lloyd, Princeton, 1950. All mathematicians live in two different worlds. They live in a crystalline world of perfect platonic forms, an ice palace. But they also live in the common world where things are transient, ambiguous, subject to vicissitudes. Mathematicians go backward and forward from one world to another. They're adults in the crystalline world, infants in the real one. S. Capel, Courant, Institute of Mathematics, 1996. At 21, Nash, the mathematical genius, had emerged and connected with the larger community of mathematicians around him. But Nash the man remained largely hidden behind a wall of detached eccentricity. He was quite popular with his professors, but utterly out of touch with his peers. His interactions with most of the men his own age seemed motivated by an aggressive competitiveness and the most cold considerations of self-interest. His fellow students believed that Nash had felt nothing remotely resembling love, friendship, or real sympathy. But as far as they were able to judge, Nash was perfectly at home in this arid state of emotional isolation. This was not the case, however. Nash, like all human beings, wanted to be close to someone. And at the beginning of his second year at Princeton, he had finally found what he was looking for. The friendship with Lloyd Shapley, an older student, was the first of a series of emotional attachments Nash formed to other men, mostly brilliant mathematical rivals, usually younger. These relationships, which usually began with mutual admiration and intense intellectual exchange, soon became one-sided and typically ended in rejection. The relationship with Shapley foundered within a year, although Nash never completely lost touch with him over the decades to follow. All through his long illness and after he began to recover, when he and Shapley became direct competitors for the Nobel Prize. When he first moved into the Graduate College a few doors down from Nash in the fall of 1949, Lloyd Shapley had just turned 26, 5 years and 11 months older than Nash. No one could have presented a stronger contrast with the childish, boorish, handsome, and uninhibited boy wonder from West Virginia. Born and bred in Cambridge, Massachusetts, Shapley was one of five children of one of the most famous and revered scientists in America, the Harvard astronomer Harlow Shapley. The senior Shapley was a public figure known to every educated household, and also one of the most politically active. In 1950, he was accorded the dubious honor of being the first prominent scientist to appear on the earliest of Senator Joseph McCarthy's famous lists of crypto-communists. Lloyd Shapley was a war hero. He was drafted in 1943. He refused an offer to become an officer. That same year, as a sergeant in the Army Air Corps in Chengdu, China, Shapley got a Bronze Star for breaking the Japanese weather code. In 1945, he went back to Harvard, where he had begun to study mathematics before he was drafted, and finished his B.A. in mathematics in 1948. When Shapley showed up at Princeton, von Neumann already considered him the brightest young star in game theory research. Shapley had spent the year after graduating from Harvard at the Rand Corporation, a think tank in Santa Monica that was attempting to use game theory applications to solve military problems, and came to Princeton while technically on leave from Rand. He was immediately recognized as brilliant and quite sophisticated in his thinking. One contemporary remembers that he talked good math, knew a lot. He did extraordinarily hard double crosstics from the New York Times without using a pencil. He was a fiercely competitive and highly accomplished player of Kriegsspiel and Go. "Everybody knew that his game was strictly his own," said another fellow student. "He went out of his way to find non-standard moves. No one was going to anticipate them." He was also well-read. He played the piano beautifully. His manner suggested an acute awareness of pedigree and prospects. When Lefschetz wrote him a letter telling him of a very generous grant if he came to Princeton, for example, Shapley replied loftily and with a hint of disdain, "Dear Lefschetz, the arrangements are satisfactory. Go ahead with the formalities. Shapley." Shapley was by no means as self-confident as his imperious note to Lefschetz implied. His appearance can only be described as rather strange. Tall, dark, and so thin that his clothing hung from him like a scarecrow's, Shapley reminded one young woman of a giant insect. Another contemporary says he looked like a horse. His normally gentle demeanor and ironic banter hid a violent temper and a harshly self-critical streak. When challenged in some unexpected fashion, he could become hysterical, literally vibrating and shaking with fury. His perfectionism, which would later prevent him from publishing a large portion of his research, was extreme. He was, moreover, acutely self-conscious about being a few years older than some of the brilliant young men around the Princeton Mathematics Department. Nash was one of the first students Shapley met at the Graduate College. For a time, they shared a bathroom. Both of them attended Tucker's game theory seminar every Thursday, now run by Kuhn and Gale while Tucker was at Stanford. The best way to describe the impression Nash made on Shapley when the two first talked about mathematics is to say that Nash took Shapley's breath away. Shapley could, of course, see what the others saw, the childishness, brattiness, obnoxiousness, but he saw a great deal more. He was dazzled by what he would later describe as Nash's keen, beautiful, logical mind. Instead of being alienated like the others by the younger man's odd manner and weird behavior, he interpreted these simply as signs of immaturity. Nash was spiteful, a child with a social IQ of 12. But Lloyd did appreciate talent, recalled Martin Schubick. As for Nash, starved for affection, how could he not be drawn to Shapley? In Nash's eyes, Shapley had it all. A brilliant mathematician, war hero, Harvard man, a son of Harlow. Favorite of von Neumann, and soon of Tucker as well. Shapley, who was popular with faculty and students alike, was one of the very few around Princeton other than Milner who could really hold Nash's attention in a mathematical conversation, challenge him and help him to pursue the implications of his own reasoning. And for that reason, along with his open admiration and obvious sympathy, he was one who could engage Nash's emotions. Nash acted like a 13-year-old having his first crush. He pestered Shapley mercilessly. He made a point of disrupting his beloved Kriegspiel game, sometimes by sweeping the pieces to the ground. He rifled through his mail. He read the papers on his desk. He left notes for Shapley. Nash was here. He played all kinds of pranks on him. Shapley's greatest eccentricity at the time was his claim that he was on a 25-hour sleep cycle. He worked and slept at extremely odd hours, often transposing night and day. Every once in a while he'd disappear from sight, another student recalled. That's what he said. We accepted anything. Waking Shapley when he was lost to the world became an ongoing prank. A group of us was attending a regular seminar at the Institute given by Deram and Kodaira. We were always very anxious to go, but only three or four of us had cars. Lloyd Shapley was one, but there was one difficulty. Lloyd liked to sleep late and was often asleep at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So we had to devise all sorts of ways to wake him. We dropped hot candle wax on him. I devised another method. We played 45 RPM records of Lloyd's favorite Chinese music without the little insert, so that it oscillated all over the place and made excruciating noise. Nash once tried to wake Shapley by climbing on his bed, straddling him, and dropping water in his ear with an eyedropper. Sometimes the jokes, also aimed at other friends of Shapley's, got totally out of hand. Shapley shared his room at the college with a graduate student in economics, Martin Shubik, who became interested in game theory and also developed a lifelong friendship with Shapley. Shubik recalled, "Nash's idea of a joke was to unscrew the electric light bulb in the bathroom. There was a glass shade under the bulb, which he filled full of water. We could easily have gotten electrocuted. Did he intend to electrocute me? I'm not sure he didn't intend to." Shubik, whom Nash insisted on calling Shubi Wooby, was a frequent target of Nash's digs. A typical put-down from a postscript to a note ostensibly commiserating with Shubik after the latter was injured in a car accident. "Oscar Lamorgue would like for someone to blast Baumol." William Baumol, then the rising young star of the Princeton Economics Department, for his impudence in publishing a paper attacking confusedly the only true utility. It's beneath his dignity, but he doesn't really think you're the best man for the job because Shubik does not write very clearly. John McCarthy, one of the inventors of artificial intelligence, also befriended Shapley and apparently aroused Nash's jealousy. One day McCarthy got an inquiry from a Philadelphia haberdashery about a massive shirt order he had placed. How good was his credit, the company wanted to know. McCarthy, who hadn't placed any such order, immediately suspected Nash and asked Shapley if Nash was the culprit. Shapley confirmed that this was highly likely. McCarthy asked the company for the original order. Sure enough, a postcard came back with Nash's unmistakable scrawl in green ink, the color Nash always used. Shubik and McCarthy cornered Nash and confronted him. There was no denying what he had done. We threatened him with postal inspectors. The post office refused to merely bawl him out. "If we do anything, we'll prosecute him," they said. Concluding that Nash had learned his lesson, Shubik and McCarthy dropped the matter. Another time he rigged up McCarthy's bed so that it would collapse when McCarthy tried to crawl under the covers. It was Shapley who reacted to Nash's absurd behavior with amused tolerance, who proposed that they might channel his mischievous impulses in a more intellectually constructive way. So Nash, Shapley, Shubik, and McCarthy, along with another student named Mel Hausner, invented a game involving coalitions and double crosses. Nash called the game, which was later published under the name So Long Sucker, "Fuck Your Buddy." The game is played with a pile of different colored poker chips. Nash and the others crafted a complicated set of rules designed to force players to join forces with one another to advance, but ultimately to double-cross one another in order to win. The point of the game was to produce psychological mayhem, and apparently it often did. McCarthy remembers losing his temper after Nash cold-bloodedly dumped him on the second-to-last round. and Nash was absolutely astonished that McCarthy could get so emotional. "But I didn't need you anymore," Nash kept saying over and over. By and large, Shapley tried to play the role of mentor. He came to Nash's aid, for example, when Tucker demanded that Nash include a concrete example of an equilibrium point in his thesis, and Nash couldn't think of a good one. Shapley spent weeks working out an elaborate but convincing example of Nash's equilibrium concept involving three-handed poker, another Shapley specialty. The friendship between the men always had a competitive edge. Shapley, who started out as the slightly older and wiser half of the relationship, may have resented Nash's reputation as a genius. He kept remarking on running starts, and he made it clear that he felt he was being left behind. Nash's stubborn independence in the face of well-meant advice, instead of delighting, began to irk. Nash's real sin, though, may have been to publish three important papers in the space of 1 year, long before Shapley had even come close to finding a thesis topic for himself. In one of them, Nash beat Shapley to the punch on a problem they were both working on and had spent many hours discussing. But Shapley actually had good reason to feel secure. Despite Nash's brilliant dissertation, the consensus at Princeton at the time was that it was Shapley who was the real star of the next generation and inheritor of the von Neumann mantle. Tucker wrote in 1953, "Shapley is the best young American mathematician working in the subject." As a person, Tucker added, Shapley is agreeable, cooperative, and well-liked by faculty and students. A letter from Frederick Bonenblust, Shapley's mentor at Rand, dated 1953, says, "Shapley perhaps lacked the wherewithal to develop a theory and depended on others for ideas, but added that he thought him second only to the creator of the theory of games, John von Neumann." A letter from von Neumann, dated January 1954, said, "I know Shapley very well, and I think he is very good. I would put him above Bonenblust, and I would bracket him with Siegel and Birkhoff." But something other than graduate-student rivalry caused a sudden break. By the middle of the next year, by which time Nash had already completed his thesis and was on the job market, Shapley told a fellow student that he would not return to Rand if Nash, who had been offered a permanent post there, were to accept it. 50 years later, Shapley made a point of correcting anyone who suggested that he and Nash had ever been close friends. Chapter 12. The War of Wits. Rand, Summer 1950. "Oh, the Rand Corporation is the boon of the world. They think all day for a fee. They sit and play games about going up in flames. For counters, they use you and me, honeybee. For counters, they use you and me." Malvina Reynolds, The Rand Hymn, 1961. The DC-3 shook as it droned past the desert and mountains toward the opaque Pacific and water-colored sky. Los Angeles lay thousands of feet below, resembling some science fiction vision of a space colony under its sulfurous blanket of haze. Nash had boarded the TWA flight in New York almost 24 hours earlier. He had not slept at all. He was rumpled, sweaty, cramped, and exhausted. But as the plane descended, he hardly registered these discomforts. His attention was wholly absorbed by the exotic panorama and his own intense excitement. Flying was still a highly novel experience in 1950, no more so than for a 22-year-old West Virginian whose travels had mostly been limited to the Norfolk and Western runs between Roanoke and Princeton. Nash's first flight marked the beginning of his career as a consultant for the secretive Rand Corporation. Rand is a civilian think tank in Santa Monica, described by Fortune in 1951 as the Air Force's big brain-buying venture, where brilliant academics pondered nuclear war and the new theory of games. Nash's on-and-off encounter with Rand over the next 4 years was a transforming experience in his life. His association with Rand at the height of the Cold War started promisingly in the summer of 1950, just as the Korean War began, and ended traumatically in the summer of 1954 when McCarthyism reached its peak. On a purely personal level, Nash's view of the world and himself was permanently and subtly colored by the Rand zeitgeist. Its worship of the rational life and quantification, its geopolitical obsessions, and its weirdly compelling mix of Olympian detachment, paranoia, and megalomania. Intellectually, it was another story. From the moment of his arrival, Nash began actively disengaging himself from the interests that, and individuals who, brought him to Rand in the first place, retreating from game theory and moving rapidly into pure mathematics, a process of disengagement that would repeat itself several times over the rest of the decade. Nothing like the Rand of the early 1950s has existed before or since. It was the original think tank, a strange hybrid of which the unique mission was to apply rational analysis and the latest quantitative methods to the problem of how to use the terrifying new nuclear weaponry to forestall war with Russia, or to win a war if deterrence failed. The people of Rand were there to think the unthinkable, in Hermann Kahn's famous phrase. It attracted some of the best minds in mathematics, physics, political science, and economics. Rand may well have been the model for Isaac Asimov's Foundation series about a Rand-like organization full of hyper-rational social scientists, psycho-historians, who are supposed to save the galaxy from chaos. And Kahn and von Neumann, Rand's most celebrated thinkers, were among the alleged models for Dr. Strangelove. Although its heyday lasted a decade or less, Rand's way of looking at human conflict not only shaped America's defense in the second half of the century, but also made a deep and lasting impression on American social science. Rand had its roots in World War II, when the American military, for the first time in its history, had recruited legions of scientists, mathematicians, and economists, and used them to help win the war. As Fred Kaplan writes of Rand's role in nuclear strategy, World War II was a war in which the talents of scientists were exploited to an unprecedented, almost extravagant degree. First, there were all the new inventions of warfare, radar, infrared detection devices, bomber aircraft, long-range rockets, torpedoes with depth charges, as well as the atomic bomb. Second, the military had only the vaguest of ideas about how to use these inventions. Someone had to devise new techniques for these new weapons, new methods of assessing their effectiveness, and the most efficient way to use them. It was a task that fell to the scientists. Initially, the scientists worked on narrow technical problems, for example, how to build the bomb, how deep to set the charges, the choice of targets. But when it became clear that people didn't know the best way to use this incredibly expensive and destructive weaponry, they were increasingly drawn into discussions of strategy. The advent of the bomb turned the temporary wartime partnership between the military and the scientific establishment into a continuing relationship. The Air Force, which controlled the new weaponry, emerged after the war as the linchpin of the national defense. Whole conceptions of modern warfare, the nature of international relations, the question of world order, the function of weaponry, had to be thought through again. Nobody knew the answers, Kaplan writes. Again, the military turned to the academic community. As Oscar Morgenstern, also a Rand consultant during the 1950s, put it in his book on defense issues, military matters have become so complex and so involved that the ordinary experience and training of the generals and admirals were no longer sufficient to master the problems. More often than not, their attitude is, "Here is a big problem, can you help us?" And this is not restricted to the making of new bombs, better fuel, a new guidance system, or what have you. It often comprises tactical and strategic use of the things on hand and the things only planned. Fortune magazine put it more succinctly. If World War II was a war of weapons, another conflict would include on both sides a war of wits at the highest level of knowledge. In the final days of the war, the Air Force generals began to worry about the brain drain of top scientists. How to keep the best and brightest thinking about military problems was far from obvious. Men of the caliber of John von Neumann would hardly sign up for the civil service. But scientists would have to have access to secrets, so one couldn't just rely on contracts with universities. The solution was a private, non-profit organization outside the military, but with close ties to the Air Force. In the fall of 1945, General Henry Hap Arnold promised to give Douglas Aircraft $10 million of leftover wartime procurement funds for a research venture to be called Project Rand. for research and development, though WITS later insisted the acronym stood for Research and Non-Development. The project was housed on the third floor of Douglas's Santa Monica plant. Friction between Douglas and the new entity led to a spin-off as a private non-profit corporation in 1946, which was when RAND moved to its downtown offices. RAND's Air Force contract gave it an amazingly free hand, according to William Poundstone's History of RAND. The contract called for research on intercontinental warfare, which, given the dominant role of nuclear weaponry, effectively gave RAND an unrestricted license to roam over the front lines of the U.S. defense strategy. Within these guidelines, RAND scientists could study anything that interested them. RAND could also refuse specific studies requested by the Air Force. From the beginning, RAND's work was a curious mix of narrowly focused engineering, cost-benefit studies, and blue-sky conjecture. A now-famous 1946 study, completed more than a decade before the launch of Sputnik in 1957, proved remarkably prescient. In Preliminary Design of an Experimental World-Circling Spaceship, RAND scientists argued that the nation which first makes significant achievements in space travel will be acknowledged as the world leader in both military and scientific techniques. To visualize the impact on the world, one can imagine the consternation and admiration that would be felt here if the U.S. were to discover suddenly that some other nation had already put up a successful satellite. RAND's civilian scientists soon made a mark on American defense policy. Poundstone reports that RAND played a leading role in the development of the ICBM. RAND convinced the Air Force to adopt in-flight refueling of jet bombers. It was responsible for the fail-safe protocol whereby bombers are kept in the air at all times, and during a crisis, head for targets in an enemy nation. Its worry that a psychotic individual in a position of power could trigger a nuclear war convinced the Air Force to adopt a safer button that required cooperation of several individuals to arm and detonate a nuclear warhead. To be plucked from academe and initiated into the secret world of the military had become something of a rite of passage for the mathematical elite. In World War II, the very best had traveled into the New Mexico desert to Los Alamos to work on the A-bomb alongside von Neumann, and to Bletchley Park, north of London, to help Turing and his team break the Nazi code. Many others, less well-known or simply younger, wound up at dozens of less famous sites working on weapon design, encryption, bomb targeting, and submarine chases. The recruitment of scientists by the military hadn't stopped when the war ended, much to everyone's surprise. Many of the mathematicians and scientists did not return to their quiet pre-war routines, but instead took on military research contracts, made frequent visits to the Pentagon and the Atomic Energy Commission, and in a few cases stayed on at Los Alamos and the other government weapons labs. For an elite cadre of applied mathematicians, computer engineers, political scientists, and economists, RAND was the equivalent of Los Alamos. The problems the military asked the scientists to solve called for new theories and new techniques, which in turn attracted the top scientific talent on which RAND's credibility depended. We had so many practical problems that involved mathematicians, and we didn't have the right tools, said Bruno Augenstein, a former RAND vice president, years later. So we had to invent or perfect the tools. Mostly, according to Duncan Luce, a psychologist who was a consultant at RAND, RAND capitalized on ideas that surfaced during the war. These were scientific, or at least systematic, approaches to problems that had been previously considered the exclusive province of men of experience. They included such topics as logistics, submarine research, and air defense. Operations research, linear programming, dynamic programming, and systems analysis were all techniques that RAND brought to bear on the problem of thinking the unthinkable. Of all the new tools, game theory was far and away the most sophisticated. The spirit of quantification, however, was contagious, and it was at RAND more than anywhere else that game theory in particular, and mathematical modeling in general, entered the mainstream of post-war thinking in economics. At that point, the military was the only government sponsor of pure research in the social sciences, a role later taken over by the National Science Foundation, and it bankrolled a great many ideas that turned out to have little true relevance for the military, but a great deal for other endeavors. Rand attracted a younger generation of mathematically sophisticated economists who embraced the new methods and tools, including the computer, and attempted to turn economics from a branch of political philosophy into a precise, predictive science. Take Kenneth Arrow, one of the early Nobel laureates in economics. When Arrow came to Rand in 1948, he was an unknown youngster. His famous thesis, written in the as-yet-unfamiliar language of symbolic logic, was a product of a Rand assignment. The assignment was to demonstrate that it was okay to apply game theory, which is formulated in terms of individuals, to aggregations of many individuals, namely nations. Arrow was asked to write a memorandum showing how it could be done. As it turned out, the memorandum became Arrow's dissertation, an attempt to restate the theories of British economist John Hicks in modern mathematical language. That was it. It took about 5 days to write in September 1948, he recalled. When every attempt failed, I thought of the impossibility theorem. Arrow showed that it is logically impossible to add up the choices of individuals into an unambiguous social choice, not just under a constitution based on the principle of majority rule, but under every conceivable constitution except dictatorship. Arrow's theorem, along with his proof of the existence of a competitive equilibrium, which also owes something to Nash, earned him the Nobel Prize in 1972, and ushered in the use of sophisticated mathematics in economic theory. Other giants of modern economics who did seminal work at Rand in the early 1950s included Paul A. Samuelson, probably the most influential economist of the 20th century, and Herbert Simon, who pioneered the study of decision-making inside organizations. Rand's location was part of its allure. The corporation's headquarters, in a once sleepy beach colony, lies 5 miles to the south of the Santa Monica Mountains at the far end of the Malibu Crescent, just west of Los Angeles. In the early 1950s, Santa Monica looked the way Nash imagined that certain towns in Italy or France might look. Wide avenues were lined with pencil-thin palm trees. Cream-colored houses were topped with tiled roofs and encircled by shoulder-high walls. Seaside hotels and rest homes were across from a seaside promenade. The magentas and reds of the bougainvillea and hibiscus were improbably intense. The breeze, surprisingly cool, smelled of oleander and seawater. Some of the best work was done in beach chairs. Rand itself was tucked out of sight of the ocean on 4th and Broadway at the edge of Santa Monica's slightly run-down business district. The 1920s bank building was a white stucco affair ornamented with Victorian flourishes. The building had recently housed the presses of the Santa Monica Evening Outlook. The newspaper had moved catty-corner to a former Chevy dealership when Rand moved in. By 1950, Rand was already spilling over into several annexes located over storefronts, including one occupied by the Outlook and a bicycle shop. A year later, when Fortune magazine discreetly introduced Rand to the wider public, it described bright walls shining through fog sunny days, and its wide, white-lighted windows shining on uninterruptedly through the night. The building is never closed, nor is it ever really open. It was one of the most difficult buildings in the United States to get into, Fortune said. On Nash's first day, members of Rand's uniformed armed police force stood guard in front of the building and in its lobby, scrutinizing him closely and memorizing his face. After that, for the rest of the summer and in subsequent years, the guards always greeted him with a cool, respectful, "Hello, Dr. Nash." There were no ID cards in those days. Inside were a series of locked doors with offices clustered by types of security clearance needed to gain access to them. The math division occupied a group of small private offices in the middle of the first floor, upstairs from the electronics shop where von Neumann's new computer, the Joniak, stood. Nash got an office to himself, a small windowless cubicle whose walls didn't quite extend to the ceiling, with a desk, blackboard, fan, and, of course, a safe.